The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Deborah Love for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Health Issues. For the next half hour, I'll be reading articles from the Mayo Clinic Health Letter. Our first article is about kidney cancer. Weight loss may have always been a goal for you, but not like this. 25 pounds lost in a few months without really trying? Worse, there's low back pain that won't stop. Symptoms like these can have a variety of causes. Kidney cancer is among them. It's one of the 10 most common cancers in the U.S., and the average age of diagnosis is 65. Sometimes symptoms such as those described above provide a clue. However, this type of cancer may come without warning, causing few or no symptoms. In many cases, it's found when medical professionals do imaging tests for a different concern. Renal cell carcinoma accounts for about 90% of kidney cancers. In most cases, the disease is caught in its early stages and often can be cured. Some small cancers can be monitored without treatment. For cancer that has spread, recent developments in treatment have improved outcomes. The kidneys are two bean-shaped organs, each about the size of a fist. They're located behind other abdominal organs, with one kidney on each side of the body. Your kidneys are major blood filters and waste removers. They also balance fluids and minerals and release hormones. Renal cell carcinoma is most often a single tumor that develops in one kidney. Less commonly, there may be more tumors, or tumors may develop in both kidneys. In its early stages, kidney cancer rarely causes symptoms. In part because of this, about 25 to 30% of those diagnosed with kidney cancer have cancer that is spread or metastasized beyond the kidneys at the time of diagnosis. There are a number of risk factors for kidney cancer, such as smoking, obesity, high blood pressure, advanced kidney disease, and exposure to workplace chemicals such as cadmium. Still, screening tests aren't recommended for the general population. They may be used if you get dialysis or have one of the several rare inherited conditions that put you at higher risk of kidney cancer. Symptoms do lead to a diagnosis at times. These include persistent back pain below the ribs, unintended weight loss, blood in the urine, fatigue, and intermittent fever. After diagnosis, the next step is to determine the cancer's extent, called the stage. This is done using further tests, such as additional imaging. The stages of kidney cancer range from 1 to 4. A stage 1 kidney cancer is small and confined to the kidney. As the cancer gets larger, the stages get higher. A stage 4 kidney cancer has grown beyond the kidney or spread to other parts of the body, most commonly the lungs, brain, liver, or lymph nodes. So first, let's talk about early stage cancer. For cancer that has not spread beyond the kidneys, there are many options. They range from actively monitoring the tumor to assess its rate of growth without active treatment, to ongoing surgery. Cancer caught and treated at this stage leads to successful outcomes, with a 5-year survival rate of 90% or higher. Let's talk about removing the entire affected kidney, called a radical nephrectomy. This involves removing the entire kidney and a border of healthy fatty tissue around it. Nearby structures, such as lymph nodes and the adrenal gland, may also be removed. The surgeon may perform the procedure through a single, large incision. This is called open nephrectomy. or the surgeon may use a series of small incisions in the abdomen to perform laparoscopic or robot-assisted laparoscopic nephrectomy. Kidney removal is considered the go-to procedure for kidney cancer. One potential downside to removing an entire kidney is the loss of that kidney's function. Fortunately, two healthy kidneys contain more filtering and waste removal capacity than you need, so the body usually functions perfectly well with a single healthy kidney. However, kidney function is watched, since it typically diminishes with age. Added factors that can harm kidneys over time include chronic kidney disease, high blood pressure, smoking, and diabetes. If your kidneys already have diminished function, removing one may make it difficult or impossible for the remaining kidney to keep up with your body's demands. For cancer that's best treated with full kidney removal, this may be a necessary trade-off that can be managed with additional steps, such as risk factor control to prevent further loss of kidney function, or even dialysis. There's also partial kidney removal, or called kidney sparing surgery. This includes removing the cancer in a small area or margin of healthy kidney tissue surrounding it rather than the entire kidney. It can be done as an open procedure, laparoscopically, or with robotic assistance. Kidney sparing surgery is a common treatment for small kidney cancers. It may be an option if you have only one kidney. When possible, kidney sparing surgery is generally preferred over a radical nephrectomy to preserve kidney function. It may also reduce the risk of later complications. Another procedure is destroying or ablating the tumor with cold or heat. Use of a thin, image-guided probe to deliver extreme cold, called cryoablation, or heat, radiofrequency ablation, to destroy a tumor offers an effective treatment option, especially for smaller tumors in the early stages, that's less invasive than surgery. Ablation can often be done as an outpatient procedure using either local or general anesthesia. Side effects are relatively rare but can include bleeding. Now let's talk about the options for cancer that spread. Surgery for advanced kidney cancer is less likely to yield a cure. However, it usually helps people live longer, and it can help improve symptoms such as pain and bleeding. About 75% of people with cancer that spread to nearby structures or lymph nodes live another 5 years after treatment. In those whose cancer has spread farther, such as to the bones, brain, or lungs, only 18% are still alive 5 years after treatment. Mayo Clinic experts say that treatments and outcomes are quickly improving. Kidney cancer drugs work in two main ways. One, by boosting the immune system to fight off or destroy cancer cells. This is called biological therapy or immunotherapy. Or two, by blocking specific signals in cancer cells that allow them to grow and spread. This is called targeted therapy. Recently, there have been significant increases in drug options for treating kidney cancer. Drug combinations or single drug treatments are typically used in a sequential manner to see how your body and the cancer responds. The most common reason to switch to another therapy is that the cancer continues to grow despite the current treatment. Another reason to switch is possible side effects. Pembrolizumab, also known as Keytruda, and nivolumab, known as Opdivo, are from a class of drugs that provide immunotherapy. They improve the immune system's ability to fight cancer cells. pembrolizumab can sometimes be used after surgery to prevent cancer from returning. Both drugs are used to treat kidney cancer that has spread. After initial treatment, it's important to see your healthcare team for follow-up visits to check for recurrence. For those on drug therapy, frequent checkups and drug adjustments are part of the treatment process. Now, on a lighter and prevention-based area, let's look at smart wearable devices. If you scroll through the data collected by the typical smart wearable, including fitness trackers, smartwatches, and smart rings, you'll see much more than your number of steps or calories burned. Many devices also estimate heart rate variability, time spent in deep sleep, and other data. However, not all this information is accurate, nor is it all helpful, says Tom Reek, an exercise specialist at Mayo Clinic, who has collaborated on several studies about smart wearable technology. According to Reek, the most useful and trustworthy smart features tend to be the easiest ones to understand and use. He suggests that we make the best use of step counters. Nearly all smart wearables do a decent job tracking daily steps, says Reek. This includes a smartphone as well as an average $15 pedometer. These trackers can motivate you to move more. He says, however, people tend to lose interest after about 6 weeks to 3 months. Once the novelty wears off, the device often ends up in a drawer. To stay motivated using this feature, Reek recommends that you A. respond to movement reminders. When your wearable gives you an "it's time to stand" message, heed the call. Get up and move around for a minute or two. Though these short breaks may not seem like they amount to much individually, they add up. B. Move your goalposts. Once you know how many steps you take on an average day, set a short-term activity goal. If you take 2,000 steps a day, consider setting a goal of adding 1,000 steps daily for 2 weeks. Once you meet that goal, add a new one. And C, share your milestones. Tell friends or family about your daily steps. You might encourage one another's progress, or you could sign up for a virtual or in-person step challenge. He adds that these devices can follow your heart rate. Higher-end smart devices estimate your heart rate to within 3 to 5 beats per minute of your actual heart rate. Just make sure your device fits snugly. Smart watches and bands shine light into your skin to measure your pulse. If there's a big gap between the device and your skin, the surrounding light can interfere with the reading, says Reek. If measuring your heart rate during a workout, make sure to tell your device that you're exercising. That way, it will take more frequent readings. When you're not exercising, you may want to note your resting heart rate, the number of times your heart beats a minute when you're not moving. First, determine your average resting heart rate over several days. Then pay attention to see if it changes. If you find that your resting heart rate is 3 to 5 beats a minute higher than usual, consider whether your body is adjusting to factors such as lack of sleep, alcohol intake, and illness or high stress. As you progress on fitness program, your resting heart rate will likely drop a beat or two a month as your heart becomes more efficient. Or if you take a long break from exercise, you might notice your resting heart rate trending upward. He advises we should understand our VO2 max. This term refers to your oxygen uptake. The V stands for volume, the O2 for oxygen, and the max for maximum. A high VO2 max makes movement feel easier because it gives you more capacity, says Reek. For example, It takes about 16 to 18 milliliters per kilogram per minute of oxygen to climb a flight of steps. If your VO2 max is 30 to 35, you'll quickly get to the top of the steps without feeling winded because you have plenty of room to spare. But if your VO2 max is between 15 and 20 milliliters per kilogram per minute, you may need a break or two along the way. Smart wearables use your exercise pace and heart rate to estimate your VO2 max. This estimate is pretty accurate, within 2 to 5 milliliters per kilogram per minute. Your target VO2 max depends on your age, weight, and sex, so make sure to input those variables into your device. As you become more fit, expect your VO2 max to trend upward within 3 to 6 months. Heat affects VO2 max, so don't worry if it temporarily drops during warmer months, like we're having now. He also advises that we should be skeptical, though, about some health data. Your smart wearable likely tracks more than your steps, heart rate, and VO2 max. However, a lot of this information is either less helpful or less accurate. Calorie counting features can be off by as much as 93%. Similarly, while most smartwatches can reliably tell your total sleep time, they do a poor job of estimating your sleep stages and number of awakenings. In addition, some smart wearables advertise technology that leads the user that tells the user when to work out and when not to, based on the variation between each heart rate, called heart rate variability, or HRV. It's thought that HRV may reflect stress and recovery levels. However, the hype over HRV is ahead of the science, says Reek. You're likely better off listening to your body. You might go easy or even skip an exercise session if you're feeling run down. But if you're focused and energized, it might be a good day for a vigorous session. This next article is about over-the-counter hearing aids, giving you some sound advice before you buy. If you find you need to turn up your TV volume, or you have trouble understanding someone on the phone, your hearing may need a little boost. In recent years, shopping for hearing aids has become a lot more convenient with over-the-counter or OTC hearing aids that are sold in stores and online without a prescription. In short, that means you don't have to have a hearing test or a doctor visit to use them, much like those cheater reading glasses. OTC hearing aids work best to help treat mild to moderate hearing loss for adults ages 18 or over. OTC hearing aids won't restore your hearing, but they'll help your ability to hear and communicate. Studies also have shown that improved hearing benefits many aspects of health, including reducing the risk of dementia and falls. But OTC hearing aids have limits. They can't treat severe or profound hearing loss. If you struggle to hear someone in a quiet setting, or have trouble hearing loud sounds, such as a truck or power tool, it's best to have an audiologist check your hearing. You may need prescription hearing aids. Sudden onset hearing loss requires the attention of your healthcare team. So here are some tips for how to go OTC. If OTC hearing aids are something you'd like to pursue, the best first step still is to get a hearing checkup, especially if only one ear is affected. Your healthcare team can check for fixable causes of hearing loss, such as earwax buildup or an infection. If you choose, you can also have your hearing tested by an audiologist. Your healthcare team can give you a referral. However, this is optional for OTC hearing aids. Next, make a list of what factors are important, such as visibility, comfort, ease of use, or cost. Decide which features matter most, such as wind reduction or directional microphones. While the U.S. Food and Drug Administration oversees OTC hearing aids, there are still some things to be wary of with these aids versus prescription versions. Before you shop, keep these tips in mind. A. Read the label. Important information must be printed on the outside package labeling. Look for the company's phone number and warnings, such as when to see your healthcare team. Also check that, quote, OTC, unquote, and, quote, hearing aids, unquote, are clearly visible on the packaging. B. Beware of misleading claims. Hearing aids, prescription and non-prescription alike, can't restore regular hearing or get rid of all background noise. Beware of advertisements, packaging, or people who claim otherwise. And C, avoid phony claims. There's no such thing as, quote, FDA registered, unquote, or, quote, FDA certified, unquote. Businesses that sell hearing aids need to register with the FDA, but the FDA doesn't approve or certify devices, and it doesn't issue registration certificates. No matter which OTC hearing aids you choose, you'll need some time and practice to get used to them. Wear them regularly for the best success and greatest boost to your health. So, here are some things to consider when shopping for OTC hearing aids. Where to shop? Shop online or retail stores such as pharmacies, electronic stores, or wholesale clubs. Style. OTC hearing aid styles include behind the ear, in the ear, or receiver in the ear. You'll fit the hearing aids yourself, so consider how easy they are to handle. Price varies, so cost is an issue. OTC hearing aids typically start at $99 a pair, but they can cost nearly $3,000. You also can buy a single hearing aid. You may want to consider insurance coverage. Some private insurance providers may cover part or all of the cost of OTC hearing aids. Accessories may be extra. Check with your medical insurance to learn what your policy covers. Typically, Medicare doesn't cover the cost of hearing aids. Then there's battery. Check if the hearing aid uses disposable or rechargeable batteries and check the battery life. Customization. Some OTC self-fitting hearing aids can be customized with smartphone apps, software, or hearing tests. Then there's Bluetooth compatibility. Some OTC hearing aids work with Bluetooth compatible devices, such as a smartphone. Bluetooth technology may allow you to adjust volume through an app, stream audio from your smartphone, or make hands-free calls. You may want to look at the warranty or return policy. OTC hearing aid makers don't need to include a warranty, but a one-year warranty that covers manufacturer defects is common. Check if there's a more extensive warranty or money-back guarantee. Find out about the store's return policy. And finally, they suggest that you try before you buy. Ask if you can have a risk-free trial. Next, our Mayo Health newsletter asks, is acetaminophen safe? Many people with ongoing pain take acetaminophen, that's Tylenol or others, for relief. It's often considered safer than other pain relievers, such as nonsteroidal anti-inflammatory drugs, or NSAIDs, when taken long-term. But recent studies have raised questions about acetaminophen's safety. A new study suggests that the drug may be associated with serious complications in people 65 and older. The study, published in Arthritis Care and Research, used data from the UK's Clinical Practice Research Data Link to compare about 180,000 people who had two or more prescriptions for acetaminophen in a six-month period, with about 400,000 people who had fewer than two prescriptions for acetaminophen over that same time span. Those who had two or more prescriptions had a 36% increased risk of gastrointestinal bleeding, a 20% increased risk of peptic ulcers, a 19% increased risk of kidney disease, and single-digit increases in heart failure and high blood pressure risks. The study looked at long-term repeated use of acetaminophen, not taking it for short-term pain such as a headache. And the study had an important limitation. It was not able to identify or track use of non-prescription acetaminophen, so it's possible that people from both groups took the drug on their own. In the UK, people over 65 receive free acetaminophen if they have a prescription, but they have to pay for a non-prescription purchase. The researchers accounted for the possibility that people who are more likely to take acetaminophen also may be more likely to take non-prescription NSAIDs, such as ibuprofen and naproxen. Mayo Clinic experts say that acetaminophen remains an important option for chronic pain and that more research is needed to understand how it may affect older adults. Talk with your healthcare team to determine the lowest dose that works to relieve your pain. Don't take more than the recommended dose, and don't drink alcohol while taking acetaminophen because that raises the risk of kidney or liver damage over time. And quickly, our last article is about yoga for lower back pain. Yoga can seem daunting when you see people twisting themselves into pretzel-like positions, but it can be done at beginner levels, and doing this ancient exercise, even in a gentle form, has many health benefits, especially when the practice is tailored to the needs of the individual. A recent study supports yoga's role in easing low back pain. The study, published in JAMA Network Open, included 141 adults. All had moderate to severe low back pain for at least 3 months, most were women. For 12 weeks, half of the participants did a form of yoga called hatha, which emphasizes holding poses for extended periods while focusing on deep breathing. They did an hour-long guided session via video each week and agreed to practice daily on their own as well. After 12 weeks, those who did yoga reported significantly more improvement in back pain relief, quality sleep, and reduction in pain medications than those who didn't do yoga. These benefits held up at 24 weeks, even though the formal study period ended after 12 weeks. That's all we have time for today's episode of Health Issues. Be sure to listen next time when I'll be sharing the 5 biggest women's health myths that need to end. Hope you enjoyed today's program. I'm Deborah Love, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Health Issues is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org.